Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review for Thursday, October 11th, 2018. We'll start with an article on page 1, headlined, Election 2018, Washington VIPs stump for Davis, Londrigan. Pence in Springfield, John Lewis in Decatur to rally Illinois voters, by Ryan Boyles. Springfield. The race for the U.S. House district that represents Decatur is attracting two nationally known political figures who will appear here. Vice President Mike Pence is coming to Springfield Friday for a fundraiser for U.S. Representative Rodney Davis, Republican of Taylorville. And Congressman John Lewis, a key civil rights figure, is having an event for Democratic challenger Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan in Decatur on Tuesday. The visitors come as the race for the 13th Congressional District continues to heat up, with each campaign this week releasing poll results that seem to be favorable to its side's chances. The Davis campaign on Wednesday released a poll by American Viewpoint, which specializes in Republican clients, showing Davis with a 13% lead on Londrigan. Earlier this week, a poll by Democratic firm GBA Strategies gave Davis a 1% edge in the race. According to the Sangamon County Republican Party's calendar, Pence will be special guest at the luncheon at Panther Creek Golf Course. Suggested donations range from $500 for individuals, $2,700 for a VIP photo opportunity, and to $12,700 for a platinum scholarship, including 4 VIP and 6 lunch tickets. The vice president recognizes the importance of ensuring Rodney returns to Congress. The path to maintaining the majority comes right through Illinois. The Democrats are targeting Rodney and dumping millions of dollars into his opponent's campaign. We can stop the blue wave right here with your help, said an email from the Sangamon County Republican Central Committee. The Decatur event, sponsored by the NAACP Decatur branch and free, is scheduled for 2:30 p.m. at Church of the Living God CWFF, 400 South Franklin Street. Lewis, a Democrat who represents Georgia in the House, was chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and helped organize the march on Washington. The poll results released Wednesday show Davis with a 50% to 37% lead on Londrigan, with 9% undecided. It also showed Davis leading among independents, 45% to 38%, and independent women, 40% to 35%. It has a margin for error of 4.9% and was conducted between September 29th and October 1st with 400 respondents. The only poll that matters is the one on Election Day, but these numbers reflect what we've been hearing on the ground, said Davis spokeswoman Ashley Phelps. Voters know Rodney. They know he fights for what's best for this district, and he transcends party lines. We won't take anything for granted, because Rodney knows every vote will be needed to win on Election Day. The GBA Strategies poll released by Londrigan's campaign found her trailing Davis 49% to 48%. That poll, with a margin of error of 4.4%, was conducted between October 1st and October 4th with 500 likely voters. Sean Savette, spokesman for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, questioned the results that show a wide gulf between the two candidates. Savette pointed to financial support for Davis from the Congressional Leadership Fund, the main political action committee dedicated to keeping the Republicans' majority in the House, which has pledged to spend more than $1 million in pro-Davis TV ads. If Washington Republicans aren't worried about Rodney Davis, Mike Pence wouldn't be coming to Springfield on Friday to help bail out his campaign, Savette said. And House Speaker Paul Ryan wouldn't be spending significant money on TV ads attacking Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. The Springfield State Journal Register contributed to this report. The Pelican Brief. The birds are back again on Lake Decatur, and here's why, by Tony Reed. Decatur. Lake Decatur is now on the official aerial guide for pelicans seeking fine Midwest dining. You can tell that because dozens of these large white birds, armed with a fish-terrorizing beak that can measure up to 15 inches long, are now bobbing around on the lake's placid waters, seeking what they may devour. It didn't used to be this way. Joe Neheiser, the lake maintenance supervisor, offered this short history, a kind of pelican brief, on how birds associated more with the Florida seashore wound up visiting here. "They've been coming to our lake probably for the last 8 or so years, said Neheiser, 56. "It first happened when there was a storm, and we believe they got blown off their migratory path and suddenly arrived here, and ever since they've been coming back. Birds of a feather tend to stick together, and, having suddenly found themselves crash-landed amid decent a la carte dining options, Neheiser believes the original birds passed a love of Lake Decatur on in their genome. Now we're possibly seeing the young of those first birds returning back here," he said. Neheiser said the pelicans, which are migratory and on their way south, first arrive around mid-July and August and will be gone by early November. Neheiser said the pelicans aren't so noticeable when they first drop in because they stick to quiet coves and other areas before venturing out into the main body of the lake as summer boat traffic dies down. "Yeah, I like them," Neheiser said. "I just think it's nice to see a different species around our lake." Melody Arnold, president of the Decatur Audubon Society, has a soft spot for them, too. Identifying the species as American white pelicans, Arnold keeps referring to them as beautiful, even though a bird that looks like it has had a pair of shears with a leather bag attached welded onto the front of its head may be prone to other descriptors. "Well, when they're flying, they're beautiful," said Arnold, 70. "But I suppose when you get up close to one, they aren't so attractive, especially if you're a fish." She said the joy of birds is that they come in so many varieties, from hummingbirds to pelicans, and yet all are so clearly recognizable as birds. She said people love them for their sheer variety and for being gifted with that one extraordinary talent mankind has envied across the millennia. "We're fascinated with them because they can fly," she added. Flying or fishing, Peggy Madden can't get enough of the pelicans. She lives fronting Lake Decatur on 44th Street and said the thrill of seeing the splashy arrival of the exotic winged visitors never gets old. "I just love them because they're so unusual," said Madden, 88. "There's never a dull moment out here by the lake." Pelican ID. The American white pelican is a huge water bird with very broad wings, a long neck, and a massive bill that gives the head a unique long shape. They have thick bodies, short legs, and short square tails. During the breeding season, adults grow an unusual projection or horn on the upper mandible near the tip of the bill. Both sexes, length, 50 to 65 inches. Weight, 158.7 to 317.5 ounces. Wingspan, 96.1 to 114.2 inches. Source, allaboutbirds.org. Entertainment. Show a happier ending for V-Shape Mind by Tim Kaine. Vic Ziantara's slumped shoulders and hanging head said more than any words he could offer, even if he'd been capable of doing so. Gloom hung in the room as V-Shaped Mind members Brad Hirsch, Jeff McElia, and Ziantara remembered and discussed what happened 15 years ago when they were certain they were on the cusp of rock stardom. 8 months later, they weren't even a band anymore. The three surviving members of V-Shaped Mind reunite Saturday, October 13th, at Bunkers in Iliopolis. V-Shaped Mind is believed to be the first Decatur band to sign a national label contract. As they made their ascendancy on the Central Illinois music scene, it certainly seemed they could do the same nationally behind the lead of childhood friend Chad Gray and his band Mudvayne. Bad timing may have been the worst offense committed by V-Shaped Mind. Music sales in the United States peaked in 1999 at $14.6 billion. As businesses will do when they're flush with cash, the music industry exploded with employees and liberally tossed money at any performer anyone thought had a possibility of sticking. With the exception of 1997, Music sales income had increased every year since 1984. The gravy train was going to go on forever, until it didn't. By 2003, sales had tumbled to $11.9 billion. As would be the case with any corporation whose income had dropped 20% in 4 years, the music industry started making cuts. Fledgling bands like V-Shaped Mind were caught in the crossfire. They were on the road and unaware of the tumult at their home label, Universal Records. "I'm doing press daily," Hirsch said. "I notice after a few days, our publicist isn't calling us. Then we find out she got fired. And when you're a baby band," McElia and Ziantara couldn't hide their disappointment, as Hirsch recounted the tale and tried to remain upbeat. 5 years earlier, it would have been a different situation, Hirsch said, but it's all a roll of the dice. A video, a second single from the album, international release of their album Cul-de-sac, all were promised to the band, but none were delivered. The vagaries and vulgarities of the music business are no stranger to anyone who spends any time around it. But the treatment of V-Shaped Mind made it clear the business was not only difficult, it could be downright cruel. It trades on youth, naivete, and unbridled enthusiasm, and makes its victims angry, bitter, and often no better off financially or artistically than they were before some management huckster put stars in their eyes while emptying their wallets. It's no longer a surprise to hear about performers' negative experiences dealing with the top end of the music business. The subject doesn't come up as often as it once did, primarily because the major labels have been halved. There are only 3 labels considered majors. And 2017's music income was $8.7 billion, the industry's best in 10 years. The positive out of V-Shaped Mind's story, however, has been present this year. McElia, Ziantara, and Hirsch have reunited to give fans another, or a first, chance to see them. They've reiterated there was no division in the ranks. The members were not necessarily happy with the decision to break up their band, but they also realized the business had backed them into a corner. Really, all they ever wanted to do was play music. Saturday night, they take that opportunity to do that again. That's the happiest ending they could have hoped for. Local and State, Mattoon School Shooter to be Sentenced, by Dave Fopay, Charleston. A year and a month after Josiah Lyons shot a fellow student at Mattoon High School, his fate should be known Thursday. The sentencing hearing for the 15-year-old is scheduled to take place. He faces a sentence based on his being a juvenile, but also an adult prison sentence that could come later. In August, Lyons admitted to a juvenile court petition, the equivalent of a guilty plea, to the charge against him in connection with the September 20th, 2017 shooting in the MHS cafeteria. The dual sentencing approach is possible because the case's judge made an adult sentence possible if Lyons commits another crime or violates terms of his juvenile sentence. Though Lyons was charged with and pleaded guilty to aggravated battery with a firearm, he could receive a juvenile probation sentence. A conviction for the adult version of that offense requires prison time, but there are no juvenile offenses that don't have probation as an option. Circuit Judge Matt Sullivan, who's presiding in the case, could also order a sentence to the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice, the juvenile version of prison. That sentence wouldn't be set for a number of years, but Lyons couldn't be held in juvenile detention past his 21st birthday. When Lyons would be released would be up to department officials. Meanwhile, Sullivan will also set the length of the adult prison sentence in the chance that Lyons ever has to serve it. For the adult equivalent of aggravated battery with a firearm, a prison sentence of 6 to 30 years is normally required with a conviction. In the case of a school shooting, the range is 30 to 60 years. However, State's Attorney Brian Bauer has said he plans to ask for a change to the charge against Lyons that would make the adult prison sentence 15 to 60 years. Lyons would start by serving whatever's imposed as his juvenile sentence. He'd be eligible for the adult prison sentence if he violates terms of his sentence, either while on probation or in juvenile detention, or during the parole period that would follow that. In case of such a violation, the state's attorney's office could file a petition asking for the adult sentence. If a judge agrees, Lyons could be ordered transferred to adult prison immediately or once he reaches a certain age. A probation sentence could include requirements for mental health treatment, such as those that have been the center of defense attorney Ed Perino's efforts since nearly the beginning of the case. Perino has been trying to find a facility to treat Lyons for diagnosed disorders, arguing that's needed to address his condition and help prevent future crimes. A psychiatrist, Lawrence Jekyll, examined Lyons as part of the court proceedings. During testimony at a hearing in February, Jekyll said he diagnosed a defiance disorder and other conditions. He said Lyons' actions were partly because of perceived bullying, but he also acted as a bully himself. Also, according to Jekyll's account, the shooting was because Lyons fought or quarreled with a fellow student, reaching a point that he decided he wanted to shoot her in the head. He took a handgun from his home to the school, but when he couldn't find the other student, he decided to go down shooting, Jekyll said. MHS teacher Angela McQueen began to subdue Lyons at nearly the same time as he fired the gun, and the shot hit and injured another student, according to account. Man gets probation for role in viral fight. By Tony Reed, Decatur. Kenneth E. Wells, the Decatur man accused of encouraging his wife in a fight with another wife and mother that went viral on Facebook, was sentenced to 18 months probation on Wednesday. Wells, 30, appeared in Macon County Circuit Court and pleaded guilty to a single count of causing the life or health of a child to be endangered. A sworn Decatur police affidavit about the fight, which took place in the 900 block of East Garfield Avenue the morning of August 18th, had described multiple children from ages 4 to 11 lined up nearby to watch. Police officer Brandon Rolfs said the children came from both families and were gathered together by their parents as spectators while their mothers punched, kicked, and wrestled on the ground. Rolfs had said any of the kids might have been injured, and none of the adults involved demonstrated any concern for their safety. The police had never described Wells as taking part in the fight physically, but said he was just as much to blame. Rolfe said Wells had unleashed a profanity-laced stream of shouted fight instructions and encouragement to his wife, Shinka L. Brown, 26, as she battled with 36-year-old Toriana R. Reed. The fight came after a child in Reed's family allegedly broke the finger of a child in Wells' family during an incident on a school bus. The two mothers then arranged via Facebook to fight each other, and a video of the altercation has been viewed 2 million times, with 44,000 shares and 16,000 comments before being taken down. Wells accepted a plea deal negotiated by his attorney, Scott Reuter, which saw Judge Thomas Griffith dismiss charges of aggravated battery and mob action. He also dismissed 6 additional charges of causing children to be endangered. Wells was on probation at the time of the wife fight. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison in 2017 after pleading guilty to aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. Griffith warned Wells that this latest conviction could affect your parole status. Presenting the case for the prosecution, Assistant Macon County State's Attorney Kate Kurtz said she had made the same plea deal offer to both Brown and Reed. This defendant is just the first to come in and take the offer, she told Griffith, and I do anticipate the other defendants will do the same. Both Reed and Brown face charges of aggravated battery, mob action, and 7 counts of endangering the life or health of a child. Reed is set for a pretrial hearing November 2nd, and Brown is scheduled for a pretrial hearing October 24th. They both have pleaded not guilty to all charges. Aspiring substitute teachers learn about jobs. By Dawn Schabing, Effingham Daily News. Effingham. A woman at the end of her career, and another about to begin hers, were among the people with a variety of qualifications, backgrounds, and life experiences who came to Effingham Unit 40 Boardroom Tuesday to learn how to fill some voids in area school districts as a substitute teacher. Paula Gephardt, a retired nurse, is looking for a way to fill her free days after working in the Vandalia Correctional Center for the past 26 years. In all, she's worked in the medical field for 30 years. Gephardt retired in March and has taught swim lessons. She's fascinated with teaching, but really didn't want to return to school. I saw this in the newspaper, and I thought I'd come listen. I'm excited. I think it will be fun, said Gephardt. I think it would be a challenge, but I also think it would be fun. On the flip side, Mariah Tabber, 24, is just graduating college and is about to wrap up her student teaching in Effingham. I'm actually student teaching at Southside right now, said Tabbert. We'll graduate in December. Districts aren't necessarily looking for teachers in January, so subbing will be nice. A substitute teaching license is valid for substitute teaching in all grades, pre-kindergarten through 12th. The license is valid for 5 years and may be renewed with the payment of registration fees without evidence of passing a test of basic skills. Subs are needed for all grade levels, the Regional Office of Education reports. But there's a process for getting a substitute teaching license. There are two different substitute teaching licenses, a regular sub-license and a short-term sub-license. Those with a bachelor's degree can get a longer-term license. New legislation passed this summer also allows those with an associate's degree to sub on short-term stints. The short-term sub-license was to help alleviate our shortage of subs, so it allows people with an associate's degree to also sub, said Julie Wallerman, Regional Superintendent of Schools ROE3, which conducted the informational meeting. But those with an associate's degree have to go through additional training. We'll be offering training soon. Wallerman encourages subs to try to venture outside their comfort zones and try subbing for all age groups and different subjects, because they might be surprised at how much they enjoy the students. ROE leaders said setting a positive tone will help in the classroom, but warned there's a line between being friendly and being the student's friend while in the classroom. Fees include $50 application fee for each license, $50 registration fee for a period of 5 years, $52 fee for fingerprint criminal history check, and a $25 processing fee for issuance of an ROE substitute teacher authorization. Also required is a physical, and the applicant must pay for that too. Once the application is approved, certificates could be issued in about 3 months or less, and the applicant could be put on several school sublists. Wallerman said school districts in ROE 3 pay between $75 and $90 per day for subs. Effingham Unit 40 pays $90. EIU petition formed for Black Lives Matter flag by Jared Jarman, Charleston. An online petition has been made to get a Black Lives Matter flag flown on Eastern Illinois University's campus in February during Black History Month. Morgan Colvin, an Eastern student, created the online petition, the Daily Eastern News reported. According to the petition on the Care2 petitions website, this would be in recognition of the Black Lives Matter movement. It is addressing police brutality and demonstrating EIU's true diversity through giving African Americans a voice, the petition reads. This is something that would be beneficial to students and faculty on this campus, making it inclusive for everyone. Colvin and others are calling for the flag to be raised on the flagpole between Andrews Hall and Lawson Hall, the Daily Eastern News report reads. According to school officials Wednesday, EIU President David Glassman had not been made aware of the matter, and no review or decision has been made. Currently, the petition has garnered 152 of the 1,000 online signatures in support of the idea, according to the petition webpage. Colvin has asked students supporting the idea to email her at mlcolvin@eiu.edu with their e-number, the personal PIN for each student at the university. The university would not be the first institution of higher education to fly the flag, should officials grant the request. The University of Vermont in Burlington, Vermont, flew the flag upon request from student government on that campus, according to a report from the Burlington Free Press in Burlington, Vermont. High schools across the country have also taken part. Black Lives Matter began as a call to action in response to state-sanctioned violence and anti-Black racism, according to the organization's website. The organization was formed in 2013 in response to the acquittal of George Zimmerman, who was accused of killing Trayvon Martin, the website states. Three radical black organizers, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi, created a black-centered political movement building project called Hashtag Black Lives Matter. The movement has also generated controversy, though, with some calling the movement anti-police in nature. This is the second time conversations of race have been raised relatively recently on Eastern's campus. Last year, Eastern's Faculty Senate called on the university to look into changing the name of Douglas Hall, which referred to Stephen Douglas, a pro-slavery candidate for U.S. Senate, in recognition of the famous debate between Abraham Lincoln and Douglas in the earlier political career of the country's 16th president. The residence hall's name was not changed. Briefs. Girl 3 found alone during fire call. Decatur. A Decatur father was given a notice to appear in court by police after firefighters, responding to reports of a house fire, found a 3-year-old girl alone in the residence. The incident happened about 7:15 a.m. Tuesday at a home in the 1500 block of East Lawrence Street. Detective Sergeant Chris Copeland said police reports from the scene described the fire call as turning out to be overheated and smoking food left on a stove. This was confirmed by a fire department report, which also said an iron had been left on. Firefighters searching the house found the sleeping girl and called in police. Copeland said the father returned home and said he had left the house about 7:15, which, if the time was correct, would mean he was gone for about 23 minutes. He said he had taken his other child to the bus stop and was also trying to chase his dog, which had gotten away, Copeland said. He said the father faces a preliminary charge of endangering the life or health of a child, which is subject to review by the Macon County State's Attorney's Office. Copeland said the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services had been informed of the incident. Hooded men break in, hold woman at gunpoint, police say. Decatur. A Decatur woman told police that three hooded men, one of them armed with a gun, smashed their way into her home early Wednesday and searched her bedroom before fleeing. Detective Sergeant Chris Copeland said the woman told officers the ordeal began when she was awakened about 1:35 a.m. by the sounds of the front door at her home in the 900 block of Westview Street being forced open. Very shortly afterward, her bedroom door was thrust open, and she said three men, all wearing hooded sweatshirts with the hoods cinched tight around their faces, rushed into the room, Copeland said. She said one of the men was armed with a semi-automatic handgun, which he pointed at her head, and told her to stay laying down. The other two began searching her bedroom. The men did not appear to find anything, and Copeland said they fled empty-handed, leaving the woman uninjured. She said remarks they made led her to believe they were gang members, he said. She says she has no idea why they would have gone into her house. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Herald and Review for Thursday, October 11th, 2018. Please stay tuned.